day, June 23, 1972. All this was taking place just as the political campaign of 1972 was getting into full swing. George McGovern was nominated by the Democratic Party as its candidate just 2 weeks after the burglary at the Democratic headquarters. From the start, Woodward and Bernstein followed the trail of the Watergate burglars with alacrity and skill and a lot of elbow grease. From the time Bob went to court and heard James McCord say CIA, he was hooked on the story. When Carl came up with Howard Hunt's address book and the two found in it the name Colson and the phrase W House, they, like Herblock, decided there was a connection to the White House. When it was discovered that numerous calls had been made from the phone of Bernard Barker, one of the burglars, to an office shared by Gordon Liddy and another lawyer at the Committee to Re-elect the President, whose acronym, CRP, quickly turned into the unfortunate CREEP, Woodward and Bernstein were off and running. On August 1st, over a month after the break-in, the first big story appeared under the joint byline of Bernstein and Woodward, reporting on the connection of the burglars to CRP. 3 weeks later, on August 22nd, President Nixon was renominated with great fanfare at the Republican National Convention in Miami. The next week, apparently trying to declare the Watergate affair finished, Nixon announced that John Dean, counsel to the president, had thoroughly investigated the break-in and said, "I can state categorically that his investigation indicates that no one in the White House staff, no one in this administration, presently employed, was involved in this very bizarre incident. What really hurts is if you try to cover it up." Again, we learned only later, from John Dean's testimony, that he had never heard of his investigation until the president made that statement. Strange indeed. On September 15th, a federal grand jury indicted the original five burglars, as well as two former White House aides, E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy. It was on that same day, but this came to light only 2 years later, that Nixon spoke to two of his aides, the White House Chief of Staff Bob Haldeman and John Dean, making threats of economic retaliation against the Post. "It's going to have its problems. The main thing is the Post is going to have damnable, damnable problems out of this one. They have a television station, and they're going to have to get it renewed, and it's going to be goddamn active here. The game has to be played awfully rough." Of our lawyer, Nixon said, "I wouldn't want to be in Edward Bennett Williams's position after this election. We are going to fix the son of a bitch, believe me, we are going to. We've got to, because he is a bad man." 2 weeks later, a seminal Bernstein and Woodward article appeared on page one of the Post. They had dug up information that there was a secret fund in the safe of Maurice Stans, former Secretary of Commerce, but finance chairman for CRP at the time, which was controlled by five people, one of whom was John Mitchell, and which was to be used to gather intelligence on the Democrats. Thus, the story reached a new level, involving Mitchell himself, not only in his new role in the campaign, but when he was still Attorney General, since Woodward and Bernstein had unearthed Mitchell-authorized expenditures from the fund from the previous year. CRP denied the story artfully and graphically. In an effort to check it out, Bernstein, having been told by a press aide at CRP that there was absolutely no truth to the charges, called Mitchell directly, reaching him at a hotel in New York, where Mitchell answered the phone himself. When Carl told him about the story, Mitchell exploded with exclamations of "Jesus!" so violent that Carl felt it was some sort of primal scream and thought Mitchell might die on the telephone. After he'd read him the first two paragraphs, Mitchell interrupted, still screaming, "All that crap! You're putting it in the paper? It's all been denied. Katie Graham's gonna get her tit caught in a big fat ringer if that's published. Good Christ, that's the most sickening thing I ever heard." Bernstein was stunned and called Bennett home to read him Mitchell's quotes and discuss adding them to the already prepared article. Ben told Carl to use it all except the specific reference to my tit. The quote was changed to read that I was gonna get caught in a big fat ringer. Ben decided he didn't have to forewarn me. Later, he told me, "That was too good to check with you, Catherine." I would have agreed with Ben's decision. As it was, I was shocked to read what I did in the paper, but even more so to hear what Mitchell had actually said, so personal and offensive were the threat and the message. I ran into Carl by accident the next day and asked him if he had any other messages for me. It was quite a temper tantrum on Mitchell's part, and especially strange of him to call me Katie, which no one has ever called me. Bob later observed that the interesting thing for him was that Mitchell's remark was an example of the misperception on the part of the Nixon people that I was calling all the shots, and that I was the one who was printing everything on Watergate. In any case, the remark lived on in the annals of Watergate and was one of the principal public links of me with the affair. Later, though, before Watergate had ended, I received a wonderful present from a California dentist who, using the kind of gold normally used to fill teeth, had crafted a little ringer complete with a tiny handle and gears that turned just like a regular old washing machine ringer. And sometime after that, Art Buchwald presented me with a tiny gold breast, which he had had made to go with the ringer. I occasionally wore the two of them together on a chain around my neck, and stopped only when a reporter threatened to tell Maxine Cheshire. In October, the tempo of the whole story picked up, and the Post printed two articles that together brought the administration's wrath down on us. The first, which appeared October 10th, described the original break-in as part of a massive nationwide campaign of political spying and sabotage conducted in behalf of the president's re-election efforts and directed by White House and re-election committee officials. This idea was dismissed by the main spokesman for the CRP as not only fiction, but a collection of absurdities. Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, began his morning briefing at the White House charging that stories are being run that are based on hearsay, innuendo, guilt by association. It goes without saying that this administration does not condone sabotage or espionage or surveillance of individuals. That same afternoon, Clark McGregor, who had taken over from John Mitchell as Nixon's campaign chairman, held a press conference in which he took no questions but read a prepared statement. He said that the Post's credibility has today sunk lower than that of George McGovern. Using innuendo, third-person hearsay, unsubstantiated charges, anonymous sources, and huge scare headlines, the Post has maliciously sought to give the appearance of a direct connection between the White House and the Watergate, a charge which the Post knows and half a dozen investigations have found to be false. The hallmark of the Post's campaign is hypocrisy, and its celebrated double standard is today visible for all to see. This and Ziegler's turned out to be only two of the salvos in a broadside against us. Naturally, I intensely disliked these attacks and, in fact, found them hard to understand. I kept remembering the moment in War and Peace, as I visualized it, when a soldier being pursued by an enemy with a bayonet thinks, "Can this man really want to kill me? Me, whom my mother loved so much?" Senator Bob Dole got in on the attack, saying that he considered what he'd read about Watergate to be a barrage of unfounded and unsubstantiated allegations by George McGovern and his partner in mudslinging, The Washington Post. To ice the cake, Dole added, "Given the present straits in which the McGovern campaign finds itself, Mr. McGovern appears to have turned over the franchise for his media attack campaign to the editors of The Washington Post, who have shown themselves every bit as sure-footed along the low road of this campaign as their candidate." Ben, cool as usual, and convinced of the orchestration of the assault on the paper, quickly responded to reporters who called by putting out his own statement. "Time will judge between Clark McGregor's press release and the Washington Post's reporting of the various activities of CRP. For now, it is enough to say that not a single fact contained in the investigative reporting by this newspaper about these activities has been successfully challenged. McGregor and other high administration officials have called these stories a collection of absurdities and the Post malicious, but the facts are on the record, unchallenged by contrary evidence." Dole attacked again on October 24th in a speech in Baltimore that contained, as counted by Woodward and Bernstein, 57 references to the Post, among them, "The greatest political scandal of this campaign is the brazen manner in which, without benefit of clergy, the Washington Post has set up housekeeping with the McGovern campaign. The Post's reputation for objectivity and credibility have sunk so low, they have almost disappeared from the big board altogether. There is a cultural and social affinity between the McGovernites and the Post executives and editors. They belong to the same elite. They can be found living cheek by jowl in the same exclusive chic neighborhoods and hobnobbing at the same Georgetown parties. It didn't help that the next day the Post's second seminal article appeared, reporting, based on Woodward's meeting with his main source, that the fifth person who was authorized to approve payments from the secret Dirty Tricks cash fund was none other than H.R. Haldeman, the president's chief of staff. When Dwight Chapin, the president's appointment secretary, had been linked by the reporters to the secret fund, they had had to find ways to explain to the American people who Chapin was and that he saw the president every day. It had been difficult to make the connection between this fund and those in power in the White House, but this second story, with its two-column, large-type headline, "Testimony Ties Top Nixon Aide to Secret Fund," was altogether different. This was Haldeman, the most powerful man in Washington after the president's alter ego and right-hand man. This article would move the Watergate storyline right through the front door of the White House. The story noted that Haldeman's participation was known to federal investigators and known from accounts of sworn testimony before the federal grand jury. In this story, with all its high visibility, the reporters unfortunately made one of their only errors throughout the long months of reporting. The substance of the story was true. The error was not of fact, but of assumption. Woodward and Bernstein had assumed that Hugh Sloan, former CRP treasurer and former Haldeman aide, had told the grand jury about the secret fund. He had, in fact, told Woodward and Bernstein about it, and the only reason he hadn't told the grand jury was that he hadn't been asked. Sloan, through his attorney, denied the Post's story the next morning, setting off repercussions everywhere, including more denunciations of the paper by Ron Ziegler at the White House, who unequivocally denied the story, accused the Post of being politically motivated, and attacked Ben Bradley for being anti-Nixon. Some of the strongest reverberations were felt at the Post. Harry Rosenfeld, who had worked on this particular story up until deadline, believed that the tie to Haldeman meant that Nixon was really at the bottom of it all. As Harry said, "If Haldeman is doing it, Nixon is doing it. There is no line between Haldeman and Nixon." Harry was apoplectic at the idea that the reporters had gotten the story wrong. He and Howard Simons were discussing corrections and desperately looking for Woodward and Bernstein, who were nowhere to be found. Ironically, those two turned out to be meeting with a publisher to discuss the book they intended to write about Watergate. When they were finally located, the reporters, with Rosenfeld, who refused to retract the story until he knew more, went down to the courthouse. "The next day we did retract the part of the story that said Sloan had told the grand jury of Haldeman's connection to the fund, but the substance of the story remained." I was feeling beleaguered. The constant attacks on us by CRP and people throughout the administration were effective and taking their toll. During these months, the pressures on the Post to cease and desist were intense and uncomfortable, to say the least. But, unbelievable as the revelations were, the strong evidence of their accuracy is part of what kept us going. Many of my friends were puzzled about our reporting. Joe Alsop was pressing me all the time, and I had a distressing chance meeting with Henry Kissinger just before the election, at a big reception of some kind.
"What's the matter? Don't you think we're going to be reelected?"
Henry asked me, seeming quite upset. I assured him that I could read the overwhelming polls as well as anybody, and hadn't the slightest doubt that Nixon would be reelected. Henry later told me that, although he was never part of any actual discussions that related to threats, he knew Nixon wanted to get even with a lot of people after the election. Maybe this had been his way of warning me. In any case, the implications in Henry's exclamation added to my tension. Readers, too, were writing me, accusing the Post of ulterior motives, bad journalism, lack of patriotism, and all kinds of breaches of faith in our effort to get the news to the people. It was a particularly lonely moment for us at the paper. Other organizations were beginning to report the story, but we were so far ahead that they couldn't catch up. Woodward and Bernstein had most of the sources to themselves. The wire service and AP sent out our stories, but most papers didn't even run them, or buried them somewhere toward the back pages. Howard used to get on the phone to his editor friends around the country to tell them they were missing a big story. Because an exclusive story usually remained so for only about 24 hours before everyone jumped on it, I sometimes privately thought, if this is such a hell of a story, then where is everybody else? Bearing the full brunt of presidential wrath is always disturbing. Sometimes I wondered if we could survive 4 more years of this kind of strain, of the pressures of living with an administration so completely at odds with us and determined to harm us. As I later wrote to Isaiah Berlin, the idea of living with that gang in the White House whacking at you for 4 more years was depressing beyond words. I couldn't help speculating about what condition we'd all be in, including the paper, at the end of it. The best we could do while under such siege, I felt, was to keep investigating, to look everywhere for hard evidence, to get the details right, and to report accurately what we found. Just as the stresses of loneliness were at their most extreme, immediately before the election, we got a break. CBS, in the persons of Walter Cronkite and Gordon Manning, then a producer and an ex-Newsweek editor, decided to run 2 long pieces on Watergate on the evening news. Basically, the story had not appeared on television. To begin with, it wasn't easy for television to report Watergate in sound bites. There were few, if any, picture opportunities, and it was an extremely complicated, hard-to-follow story, full of names of people unknown to the public. There were many different threads to the story, and it was difficult to see how it all came together. And then, as I was soon to learn firsthand, television and radio were vulnerable, relying as they do on a government agency for their licenses to operate. The 3 television networks all owned local radio or television stations, from which a large part of their profitability derived, so it took even more than normal courage for them to take on the government. But Cronkite, who was the supreme authority on his show, decided to go ahead. Manning, who knew Ben from Newsweek, tried to get his help for CBS's program and was startled and dubious when Ben told him we had no documents, no paper trail of evidence, and couldn't help. The first piece aired on the evening of Friday, October 27th, and took 14 of the 22 minutes of that night's network news, more time than had ever been given to any single story, filled largely by quoting the Post and the government's various replies to the paper's charges. I will never forget my joy and relief to have CBS News behind us, piecing the story together and carefully explaining to a national audience what had happened, what had been proved, and what had not. Cronkite gave us great credit, and the still photos of the Post and its headlines in the background helped enormously. The show ran 11 days before the election. Also watching the CBS Evening News was the White House tough guy, Chuck Colson, who was assigned to oversee the networks. Colson became known for saying that he would walk over his grandmother if it was necessary to do a job. He had gotten wind of the show, called Frank Stanton, and then gone straight to Bill Paley. Stanton had worked hard at CBS to protect press freedoms and the news division, but Paley had not experienced calls from angry presidents or their flunkies, so he flinched at Colson's call and in turn summoned the head of news, Richard Salant, and leaned on him very hard about the evils of the piece that had already been aired and the necessity of killing the proposed second part to be run the next night. After a fight within CBS News, Salant compromised, and on the grounds of repetition of what had already appeared on the network, the second piece was cut from 14 minutes to 8. In the end, the length of the report didn't really matter. CBS had taken the Post national, even against Bill Paley's frightened will. I spent the day after the first CBS story aired at Glen Welby with a large group of guests, including my friend Pam Barry, by then Lady Hartwell, Clay Felker, Dick Holbrook, and, most interestingly, Peter Peterson, Nixon's Secretary of Commerce at the time, and his then-wife Sally, a liberal Democrat. Sally was quite vocal in her views, and there were several awkward moments during the weekend, particularly when she announced emphatically that she would be voting for McGovern, which actually was known to the White House, and made remarks openly critical of the administration, at one point saying, "Nixon has no balls." We all squirmed, but it was also noticeable that Pete didn't come to his boss's defense. In the middle of a tennis game, Pete was called to the phone by a White House operator who had placed the call for Haldeman. Having to locate Pete at my house undoubtedly was a factor in the administration's later getting rid of him. It was not a winning card to be weekending at Glen Welby, although Henry Kissinger didn't seem to suffer within the administration, even though he went on coming to my house, but not to the Post, during Watergate. Pete remained a friend of mine throughout our reporting of Watergate. In fact, he told me that after the Post's late October stories, my name came up in White House staff meetings even more often than before. Having heard plenty of comments that they were going to get me, Pete came to my office by himself one day to say, "Kay, I don't know what the truth is, but there is a group of very angry people who feel you are out to get them. I hope you are using rigorous journalistic standards. If you are wrong, it's serious. They will get you." I appreciated the spirit in which Pete courageously came to see me and assured him that I heard what he was saying and that we were being careful. Indeed, we were. We always did our best to be careful and responsible, especially when we were carrying the burden of the Watergate reporting. From the outset, the editors had resolved to handle the story with more than the usual scrupulous attention to fairness and detail. They laid down certain rules, which were followed by everyone. First, every bit of information attributed to an unnamed source had to be supported by at least one other independent source. Particularly at the start of Watergate, we had to rely heavily on confidential sources, but at every step we double-checked every bit of material before printing it. Where possible, we had three or even more sources for each story. Second, we ran nothing that was reported by any other newspaper, television, radio station, or other media outlet, unless it was independently verified and confirmed by our own reporters. Third, every word of every story was read by at least one of the senior editors before it went into print, with a top editor vetting each story before it ran. As any journalist knows, these are rigorous tests. Yet, despite the care I knew everyone was taking, I was still worried. No matter how careful we were, there was always the nagging possibility that we were wrong, being set up, being misled. Ben would repeatedly reassure me, possibly to a greater extent than he may have actually felt, by saying that some of our sources were Republicans, Sloan especially, and that having the story almost exclusively gave us the luxury of not having to rush into print so that we could be obsessive about checking everything. There were many times when we delayed publishing something until the tests had been met. There were times when something just didn't seem to hold up, and accordingly was not published, and there were a number of instances where we withheld something not sufficiently confirmable that turned out later to be true. At the time, I took comfort in our two sources policy. Ben further assured me that Woodward had a secret source he would go to when he wasn't sure about something, a source that had never misled us. That was the first I heard of Deep Throat, even before he was so named by Howard Simons, after the pornographic movie that was popular in certain circles at the time. It's why I remain convinced that there was such a person, and that he, and it had to be a he, was neither made up nor an amalgam or a composite of a number of people, as has often been hypothesized. The identity of Deep Throat is the only secret I'm aware of that Ben has kept, and of course Bob and Carl have too. I never asked to be let in on the secret, except once, facetiously, and I still don't know who he is. This attention to detail and playing by our own strict rules allowed us to produce, as Harry Rosenfeld later said, the longest-running newspaper stories with the least amount of errors that I have ever experienced or will ever experience. The impact of our October stories and the CBS broadcast continued to reverberate on Nixon and his administration and on us. There was a good deal of evidence that the campaign to undermine public confidence in the Post and in any other news medium thought to be hostile to the administration was intensifying. The investigation of such a tangled web of crime, money, and mischief would have been hard enough under the best of circumstances, but it was made harder given the unveiled threats and major and minor harassments by a president and his administration. Chuck Colson was quoted by a Star reporter as saying, "As soon as the election is behind us, we're going to really shove it to the Post. Start coming around with a breadbasket because we're going to fill it up with news, and that's only the beginning. After that, we're really going to get rough. They're going to wish on L Street that they'd never heard of Watergate." I particularly loathed reports that personalized the whole dispute, implying that some sort of personal vendetta had poisoned the relationship between the Post and the administration. I had already begun to hear a chorus of rumors concerning my own feelings about Nixon, a chorus that warmed up with some help from Senator Dole, who made a charge, picked up and carried all over the airwaves, saying that I had told a friend that I hated Nixon. Dole made the leap to saying that that was the reason the Post was writing all the negative Watergate stories. I detested the assumption and impression that we were out to get Nixon, that we somehow had it in for him and for the Republicans. Many people misunderstood the role of the Post, believing that we got some sort of enjoyment out of kicking the president and the Republicans, or extracting every last drop of blood, as I heard more than once. Far from its being our aim or purpose, we got no pleasure from it. As I wrote someone, "It's the only government we have, and it would be a lot bigger pleasure not to have to report the kind of things we do." Incredibly, I was still in touch with John Ehrlichman from time to time, so I wrote him on the day before the election. "A short while back, you threw me a message over the fence, and I genuinely appreciated it. Here is a message I want to send you. Among the charges that have been flying over the past few weeks, many have disturbed me for the general misunderstanding they suggest of the Post's purposes in printing the stories we do. But none has disturbed me more than an allegation Senator Dole made. It was that the Post's point of view on certain substantive issues was explained by me as proceeding from the simple fact that I hate the president. There are so many things wrong with this anecdote that one hardly knows where to begin in correcting them. But I would begin with the fact that I cannot imagine that the episode ever took place at all, or that I ever expressed such a childish and mindless sentiment, since it is one that I do not feel. I want you to know that, and I also want you to know that the fiction doesn't stop there, for the story suggests as well that somehow editorial positions on public issues are taken and decisions on news made on the basis of the publisher's personal feelings and tastes. This is not true. Even when the sentiments attributed to me, unlike this alleged and unworthy hate for the president, may be real. What appears in the Post is not a reflection of my personal feelings, and by the same token I would add that my continuing and genuine pride in the paper's performance over the past few months, the period that seems to be at issue, does not proceed from some sense that it has gratified my personal whim. It proceeds from my belief that the editors and reporters have fulfilled the highest standards of professional duty and responsibility. On this, I know we disagree. I am writing this note because I think we have enough such areas of sharp and honest disagreement between us not to need a harmful and destructive overlay of personal animosity that I, for one, don't feel and don't wish to see perpetuated by misquotation. My turn, it seems. I genuinely meant what I wrote Ehrlichman. I have a faint memory of talking to Stu Alsop once about how, as the months progressed, I was certainly feeling more and more negative about Nixon, but I had no such personal feelings about Nixon as a politician and couldn't imagine that I had said anything like Dole's quote in his speech, much less that my feelings toward the president would inspire the Post's editors and reporters. Though the editorial page editor and his deputy and writers were certainly not in agreement with George McGovern's views and policies, the Post's editorial page, which didn't endorse, had vaguely seemed to favor McGovern, partly because it was so unsympathetic to Nixon. Candidate McGovern had used the Watergate story only somewhat tentatively. Ironically, he too felt that the coverage he received in the Post had not been ample enough or accurate or fair, a feeling shared by almost every candidate, about almost every paper anywhere and at any time. To no one's surprise, President Nixon was re-elected by a landslide, with 61% of the vote and 49 out of 50 states, evidence of how little impact Watergate had had, and how very powerful were these angry and vindictive men in the White House and connected with the president elsewhere. However, instead of becoming more secure with his victory in hand and working to unite the country, Nixon immediately turned to vengeance and to strengthening his hold on power. In a speech at his victory dinner with members of the administration, he mentioned the Washington Post several times. He asked everyone in the upper echelons of his administration to resign and set out to replace anyone, even good Republicans, who might not agree with him implicitly. One of the first victims was Pete Peterson, who was politely fired soon after the election. The Wall Street Journal ran an article at the time, speculating openly on what had been on all our minds, that Peterson might have been knifed by the White House inner circle. The article quoted someone from the White House as saying, "How can you trust a guy who has dinner with Kay Graham?" Tom and Joan Braden had a goodbye party for Pete, which was reported in the Post by Sally Quinn. At the party, Pete, by this time fed up with the treatment he'd received from the administration, gave a highly irreverent response to the toasts. He described being sent for to go to Mount David and being quizzed about his dubious friends in a loyalty test. Finally, Peterson told the guests, according to Quinn, he failed the physical test, his calves were too fat, and he could not click his heels. Right after the election, with the atmosphere between the Post and the president at its most poisonous, the Watergate story dried up. Our having nothing new to report fed the idea that the whole story had been political to begin with, a baseless, biased attack on the president by the Post for the sake of influencing the election. According to Phil Jalen, that was the only time that Ben actually asked him to think about writing editorials on the subject. "He told me it wouldn't hurt if you just wrote an occasional editorial saying what the hell's happened to this investigation and why isn't it going forward." Editorials did appear. And on the news side, Harry Rosenfeld was nagging Woodward and Bernstein, hounding them to dig even deeper to keep at the story, which of course they did. Later on, I added a note to the file about something Ben said that applied to this period when the story seemed to be going nowhere. His comment reflected his attitude then and always. "Low profiles are a lot of shit." That fall, after the election, partly in response to the escalating campaign we felt was being waged against the reputation of the Post, I began to make more speeches defending the press in general and the Post in particular. One of the first big ones was to the San Francisco Commonwealth Club, quite a conservative group. Meg led the team that worked on the speech, which was a strong defense of freedom of the press. I was in something of a panic about the question period to follow the speech, worrying that I would be quizzed on the minutiae of the Watergate story and not know all the players or the various events relating to it. Meg gave me a chronology of the complicated events that had been put together by the Democratic National Committee, and I took it with me to study on the plane on the way out. I settled into my seat for the cross-country flight and began to look over this document, but promptly fell asleep. I woke up as we landed, at which time the man across the aisle from me leaned over to say, "Hello, Mrs. Graham. Can I help you with your bag?" I looked up into the eyes of Senator Dole and was immediately frozen with fear that he had seen me studying the Democratic Party-prepared document, since this was not long after his accusations that we were reporting Watergate because I hated Nixon. However, either he hadn't observed it or else he was being polite, but he was very friendly, helped me off the plane, and did indeed carry the bag for me. We talked pleasantly, and I finally worked up my nerve to say, "By the way, Senator, I didn't say I hated Nixon." "Oh, you know," he casually replied, "during a campaign they put these things in your hands and you just read them." His reaction amazed me, dismissing so lightly something that had had such a powerful effect on all of us at the Post, especially me. At the same time that the administration granted an exclusive interview to the Washington Star, it started a boycott of sorts on us. Specifically, as an anonymous White House aide told Time magazine, "To screw the Washington Post." The thinking was, Time reported, "How can we hurt the Post the most?" We were not to have our calls answered, not to be dealt with professionally in any way. Administration people were not to come to editorial lunches, and certainly not to my house for dinner. A uniquely ludicrous, petty, and rather weird form of vengeance took place when the administration excluded our charming, much respected, and even loved senior society reporter, Dorothy McArdle, then 68 years old, from covering parties, and made her sit alone, cooling her heels in the press room, barring her from one social event after another. The strategy backfired, for Dorothy soon became something of a heroine to her colleagues in the Washington Press Corps. In fact, the Star gallantly ran an editorial supporting us and opposing the ban, stating that if the Post couldn't cover the parties, the Star didn't want any favors. Their social reporter, Isabel Shelton, would join Dorothy in the press room, declining to attend the events as long as Dorothy couldn't. I wrote Newbold Noyes, thanking him for the nicest, most generous-minded statement I can imagine in behalf of the competition. Moreover, I wrote that I considered it vitally important, in the light of all that's going on, for the powers that be to know that we care about the ethics of our profession and will stick together. Their divide-and-conquer attitude seems very determined. A few weeks later, David Broder reported in a piece in the Post that Richard Kleindienst, by now the Attorney General, said that he thought the Washington Post had exaggerated or distorted on occasions in its coverage of the case. Kleindienst also said that he had told me that the administration is being no more unfair to the Post, in barring its reporters from some White House social events, than the Post was to the administration in some of its reporting on Watergate. Broder's piece quoted Kleindienst as saying, "I told her, don't get so upset. You've got a great paper. Go ahead and run the thing the way you want. But don't be surprised if the president gets a little upset and does something a little shitty to you in return." Indeed, the administration was doing something a little shitty in return. It was embarked on a deliberate policy to undermine the credibility of the press, with, as it turned out, very good reasons for needing to do so. And although there was not a lot of concrete evidence, we at the Post were well aware of being the target of Nixon and the administration's vengeance. On November 13th, Colson again attacked the Post, singling out Ben Bradley. "The charge of subverting a whole political process, that is a fantasy, a work of fiction rivaling only Gone with the Wind in circulation and Portnoy's complaint for indecency. Mr. Bradley now sees himself as the self-appointed leader of the tiny fringe of arrogant elitists who infect the healthy mainstream of American journalism with their own peculiar view of the world." It was just 2 days after this, we later learned from the Watergate indictments, that Colson had a telephone conversation with Howard Hunt about the need for more payments to the defendants in the trial. Another thing we found out only later was that at one point Nixon had a plan to get Richard Mellon Scaife, the right-wing Pittsburgh millionaire, according to reporter Nick Lemon, who discovered the notes Ehrlichman made on a meeting he had with the president, to buy the Post. The evidence that turned up in the Nixon archives was Ehrlichman's notes on a December 1, 1972 meeting he had with Nixon. "Post, Scaife will offer to buy it, assets, suit by public SH shareholders, if she, 60%, who controls this much of the A shares, refuses. President can't talk to him." On December 4th, Kenneth Kachigian, an aide to Pat Buchanan, then a White House speechwriter, sent Buchanan a memo that was highly specific about what was to be done with the Post as a target. "Colson called this morning with a project that the president wants done." The memo went on. "They want an article, magazine length, on the worst things the Washington Post has said about RN, the ad hominem stuff. It should go back as far as the 50s to point out their vicious opposition to RN. The storyline would be that the Post's 1972 vendetta was the ultimate frustration. After years and years of heaping scorn and abuse on RN, the public was overwhelmingly supporting RN, something the Post simply could not stand, thus the increasing stridency from them and the irresponsibility of Watergate. Colson says it ought to be a butcher piece, perhaps for the New York Times magazine." Obviously, the negative atmosphere between the Post and the Nixon White House had predated Watergate. My heated back and forth with Vice President Agnew in 1969 and 1970 was part of the venomous mood. Several memos from 1970 were to come to light, specifically detailing the administration's dislike for the Post and its desire to hurt us. For example, after Nixon's State of the Union message that year, and after the administration had reviewed the unfavorable editorial and columnar reaction to it, someone on the White House staff sent John Ehrlichman a memo saying, "The following newspapers and columnists are individuals who are beyond appeal. He, Nixon, notes that we simply shouldn't have our people spend any time with them. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Courier, the Louisville Courier-Journal, the Nashville Tennessean, Martin Nolan of the Boston Globe, and Richard Dudman of the Post-Dispatch." The following month, Haldeman drafted a memo for Jeb Magruder, then his aide, saying, "We have got to move now in every effective way we can to get them working to pound the magazines and the networks in counteraction. Concentrate this on the few places that count, which would be NBC, Time, Newsweek and Life, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. Don't waste your fire on other things." Someone else, not identified, sent Magruder a talking paper that spelled out some actions to take against the Post. 1. Put someone on the Washington Post to needle K. Graham. Set up calls or letters every day from the viewpoint of, "I hate Nixon, but you're hurting our cause in being so childish, ridiculous, and overboard in your constant criticism, and thus destroying your credibility." 2. Lynn Nofziger should work out with someone in the House a round-robin letter to the Post that says, "We live in Washington, D.C., read the D.C. papers, but fortunately we also have the opportunity to read the papers from our home districts and are appalled at the biased coverage the people of Washington receive of the news compared to that in the rest of the country, etc." 2 months later, in May 1970, Nixon himself got in on the act. He sent a memo to Haldeman. "I would like for you to have a talk with Klein and Ziegler with regard to some very strict instructions on the handling of the New York Times and the Washington Post. I will make these instructions precise, and I want them carried out precisely for the next 60 days. With regard to the Washington Post, I reaffirm the directive I gave 2 weeks ago, but which has not been carried out. Ziegler, under no circumstances, is to see anybody from the Washington Post, and no one on the White House staff is to see anybody from the Washington Post or return any calls to them. They are to be handled as part of the general press corps. This includes Kilpatrick, Oberdorfer, and everybody else. I realize the argument that has often been made that Oberdorfer 1 time out of 10 gives us a good story. I am now reiterating the policy that I want followed out. Just treat the Post absolutely coldly. All of their people are to be treated in this manner. If there is any exception to this directive, you are to raise it directly with me, and I will determine on a case-by-case basis, but under no circumstances will any individual on our staff, on his own, move in other directions. At the same time, I want a policy in which the Washington Star, the Washington Daily News, the New York Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, and for the time being, the Los Angeles Times and others who may be competitive with the New York Times and Washington Post, continue to receive special treatment when Ziegler and Klein may determine it is in our interest. They will not agree with this policy, but it is one I have decided upon after long consideration, and I want it carried out." All of this was the background against which Watergate unfolded. The pressures on us, up to that point, however, were nothing to those that followed. On the very day of CBS's first report, October 27th, Colson sent a memo to another White House staffer. "Please check for me when any of the Washington Post television station licenses are up for renewal. I would like to know what the upcoming schedule is." Coincidentally, but luckily for the administration, renewals for stations in Florida were due in early January 1973, and these licenses, as Colson well knew, were a sure way the government could hurt us. Of all the threats to the company during Watergate, the attempts to undermine our credibility, the petty slights, and the favoring of the competition, the most effective were the challenges to the licenses of our 2 Florida television stations. There were 3 separate challenges in Jacksonville and 1 in Miami, all of which, not coincidentally, were filed between December 29, 1972, and January 2, 1973, leading us to the easy conclusion that the 4 petitions must have been orchestrated. Out of more than 30 stations in the state of Florida up for renewal, our stations were the only ones challenged. Some sort of record particularly for stations whose news and community service ranked among the best in the United States. By this time, we were so embattled at the paper that I, and most of us at the company, viewed the challenges as entirely politically motivated by people sympathetic to Nixon or even associated with CRP. Did the White House actually encourage or even originate these challenges? In light of all the threats and memos that have since surfaced, it's easy to believe that Nixon and his co-conspirators were behind them, but we never found a paper trail leading to a direct connection. Maybe we didn't have to, so closely tied were many of the prominent figures to the White House or the committee to re-elect the president. No doubt there was a mixture of motives among the challengers. The perception of blood in the water, easy pickings, and understandable thinking that the atmosphere was right, given the Nixon-dominated FCC. There was also dissatisfaction, if not real dislike, on the part of some of the challengers for our strong, aggressive news organizations, especially in Jacksonville, to which the conservative nucleus that ran the city was unused. We could see why some groups didn't like the performance of the two stations. Both had played a not insignificant role in the passage of Florida's corporate income tax and the Florida Sunshine Law. No doubt, too, some of those in the challenging groups also misunderstood the complex FCC process and underestimated the legal costs involved. Few of the challengers had any broadcasting experience. Of course, the groups had ensured that there was the required sprinkling of minorities, who would profit mightily from being given a few shares in order to lend diversity. One common element of the challenging groups was that each tried to depict itself as the local, civic-minded small team versus the large, out-of-state corporation, making the challengers appear valid in contrast to the outsiders, as we were branded in both cities, even though we had operated in Jacksonville for 20 years and my husband's family had long been prominent citizens of Miami. Though there were plenty of declarations of a high-minded desire to bring the stations under local management, it's significant that no challenge was raised against another station owned by Rustcraft Broadcasting Company in New York. In Jacksonville, one challenger was the Florida Television Broadcasting Company, whose big players included George Champion, a personal friend of Nixon's, who had been the chief Florida fundraiser for his 1972 re-election campaign. It also included the powerful Ed Ball, a close business associate of the national vice chair of Democrats for Nixon in 1972, and one of Florida's wealthiest financiers. Another group challenging the license, the Trans-Florida Television Company, included Glenn Seedham, former general counsel of CRP, and deputy general counsel of the 1973 Presidential Inauguration Committee. The third group, St. John's Broadcasting, consisted of businessmen thrown together hastily and knowing nothing about broadcasting. Nixon's close friend, Cromwell Anderson, was one of the leaders of a challenging group in Miami. He had participated in an earlier challenge there against WPLG late in 1969, one that was withdrawn after 7.5 months when post-Newsweek stations agreed to pay the challengers $67,000 in legal fees under an FCC provision then applicable, but now no longer in effect, and he led the fight to mount another challenge now. Anderson had been a neighbor of Nixon's, had sold him his Key Biscayne property, and had introduced him to Bebe Rebozo. Another member of the group in Miami was Edward Claughton, whose home Agnew had stayed in during the 1972 Republican convention. Anderson began to move against our station in Miami in September of 1972. This happened to be the same month when Nixon, as later heard on the tapes, said that the Post would have damnable, damnable problems about our license renewals, a phrase that was censored when the tapes were first released by the White House. To my sorrow, Phil's old friend George Smathers and George's brother Frank aligned themselves with the Miami challengers. Norm Davis had gone to WPLG to be deputy to general manager Jim Lina just as the challenge there had gotten into full swing. These two men decided to meet with the challengers to size them up. What they heard was vituperative and bitter diatribe, much of it focused on me, as reflected in someone's calling me the Dragon Lady. "They didn't even know you," Norm recalled. "Not one of them had met you.
but in their minds you were somebody sinister who was pulling the strings. Much of my time, and certainly a great deal of my energy and emotional strength, was taken up with activities in relation to this threat and in listening to grievances from some of the powerful and influential members of each community who threatened to join the Challengers. I flew down to Jacksonville more than once to meet with such people in an effort to mollify negative feelings about the station. Since I wanted to do anything helpful to the stations, I was pleased when one of my very few friends left in Jacksonville, a moderate Republican civic leader, Roger Main, called me. He was the head of the St. Luke's Hospital Association, which had suddenly lost its speaker for its annual dinner, and to my astonishment, he asked me for help in getting Attorney General Kleindienst to come to speak, and if not Kleindienst, Representative Jerry Ford. Kleindienst was one of the few administration officials who had always been reasonably friendly to me, so I agreed to try, and he accepted. Roger Main invited me to the dinner at the Jacksonville Civic Auditorium, and I accepted with alacrity, an excuse to see the whole group. The evening was not an easy one, however. Only Roger and another friend, Ed Lane, were even polite to me. I somehow got through the reception and dinner, but after dinner, the leading lights said goodnight to me and took Kleindienst off to a party, so I didn't win many points for providing their speaker. The timing of these challenges made them potentially devastating, coming not only in the thick of Watergate, but also just a year and a half after the Pentagon Papers and after we had gone public. More important, Fritz had been working hard to acquire the company's fourth television station in Hartford, Connecticut. We were naturally concerned that the Travelers Insurance Company, the seller, would get cold feet in the face of the challenges and that the sale wouldn't go through, but Travelers stayed true to its word and didn't hesitate. That company's relationship with Fritz was solid, and the deal was closed. From the point of view of Watergate, the challenges came during the time when the story had dried up after the election, and we were sweating about where the trail had gone. Others wondered, too. The administration's power and anger were at their greatest after the landslide election, and we were at our weakest. Our public stance throughout the license challenges was that we were confident of renewal. Indeed, we had reason to be confident. At each station, we had strong local management, and we emphasized independent news and editorial judgment. Both Florida stations had impeccable reputations for integrity and programming of high quality. We had met, even exceeded, all of the FCC tests for a good station. One reason I personally felt we ought to be safe was that I didn't see how the FCC could take away our licenses without jeopardizing virtually every television licensee in the country, or at least making them all nervous, including Nixon friends and admirers. So well had we run these stations. But despite our confidence that the challenges were unfounded, we were scared. Among the worst effects was the sharp decline in our stock price that naturally ensued, from $38 a share to $28 in the first 2 weeks after the challenges, and continuing on down to $16 or $17, decreasing the value of the company by more than half. As for the direct effect on our finances, the legal costs of defending the licenses added up to well over $1 million in the 2.5 years the entire process took, a far larger sum then than now for a small company like ours. Equally important were the eroding effects on the people trying to run the stations with these threats hanging over their heads and in this hostile atmosphere. We tried to reassure them by telling them to go on as they always had, but decisions are hard to make under such circumstances. At neither station could we recruit people easily, since there was concern about who would hold the license in a few months' time. It was also difficult to air the kind of advocacy editorials we wanted to, knowing they would be used against us. The Washington Post Company had been in the public eye for several months, certainly more than I was comfortable with, and in ways we might not have wished. We didn't seek out the celebrity, it was thrust on us. During a Newsweek sales meeting at the time, I said it reminded me somewhat of the old story about the man who'd been tarred and feathered and ridden out of town on a rail. When asked how he felt, he said, "Except for the honor of the thing, I would rather have walked." By early 1973, I was growing increasingly anxious
and thought I ought to meet with Woodward and Bernstein in addition to the editors. Surprisingly, to this point, 7 months into the story, I had had hardly any contact with the reporters. So, on January 15th, Bob and Howard and I sat down to lunch together. Carl was out of town. Characteristically, Bob went right downstairs to the newsroom afterwards and made extensive notes about what we'd said, even going so far as to write down what we ate, the main course being Eggs Benedict, which led to our future reference to this gathering as the Eggs Benedict lunch. My apprehensions about the whole Watergate affair were evident.
"Is it all going to come out?" Woodward reported that I asked anxiously. "I mean, are we ever going to know about all of this?"
As Bob later wrote, he thought it was the nicest way possible of asking, "What have you boys been doing with my newspaper?" He told me then that they weren't sure all of it ever would come out. Depression seemed to register on her face.
"Never?" she asked. "Don't tell me never."
It was also at this lunch that Woodward told me he had told no one the name of Deep Throat.
"Tell me,"
I said quickly, and then, as he froze, I laughed, touched his arm, and said that I was only kidding. I didn't want to carry that burden around. He admitted that he was prepared to give me the name if I really wanted it, but he was praying I wouldn't press him. This luncheon was reassuring for me, or at least I gave the appearance of being reassured, but I remained nervous. Looking back, I'm surprised I wasn't even more frightened. The period leading up to the trial of the Watergate Seven, which began on January 8, 1973, had been extremely tense. Colson was talking around Washington about going to our national advertisers or our investors. A Wall Street friend of mine, Andre Meyer, a man with administration contacts, called me and asked me to come to see him. When I did, he advised me to be very careful of everything I did or said, and, just like in the movies, he warned me not to be alone.
"Oh, Andre," I said, "that's really absurdly melodramatic. Nothing will happen to me."
"I'm serious," he said. "I've talked to them, and I'm telling you not to be alone."
Andre never explained what his fears were based on, and I still have no idea what he had heard or even meant, but I certainly got the point about how serious he was. I lay awake many nights worrying, though not about my personal safety. Beyond its reputation, the very existence of the Post was at stake. I'd lived with White House anger before, but I had never seen anything remotely like the kind of fury and heat I was feeling targeted at us now. It seemed at times that we should really be worrying about some bizarre Kafkaesque plot, that maybe we were being led down a road to discredit the paper. The moments of anxiety increased in quantity and intensity. Naturally, we were worried when our stories were denied repeatedly and vehemently. Even we, it seems, underestimated for a long time the capacity of government to hide and distort the truth. Finally, a series of events began to unfold in our favor. 3 days after the beginning of the trial, Howard Hunt pleaded guilty to 6 of the charges against him. 4 days later, the other burglars followed suit. On January 30th, Liddy and McCord were convicted, continuing to claim that no higher-ups were involved and that they had not received any money. In fact, Hunt had urged the burglars to plead guilty and go to jail, assuring them he would take care of them. Toward the end of February, a civil subpoena was served on 5 of us from the Post, and we were ordered to appear in the U.S. District Court to testify on our sources in the Democratic Party's civil suit against the Committee to Re-elect the President. The subpoena required that we produce a whole host of material, including documents, papers, letters, photographs, tapes, manuscripts, notes, copies, and final drafts of stories about Watergate. As Ben Bradley put it, they asked us to bring everything except the lint in our pockets. My name was misspelled, but I was subpoenaed, along with Woodward and Bernstein, Howard Simons, and another reporter, Jim Mann, who had worked on a few of the early Watergate stories. Our lawyers decided to give me some of the reporters' notes. Bradley had reassured Bernstein and Woodward that we would fight this case for as long as it took, adding,
"And if the judge wants to send anyone to jail, he's going to have to send Mrs. Graham, and my God, the lady says she'll go. Then the judge can have that on his conscience. Can't you see the pictures of her limousine pulling up to the women's detention center, and out gets our gal, going to jail to uphold the First Amendment? That's a picture that would run in every newspaper in the world. There might be a revolution.
At some point, Woodward had met with Deep Throat, who told him that the subpoenas were part of a response induced by Nixon's rampage against the Post, and that he, Nixon, would use the $5 million left over from his campaign to take the Post down a notch. "It will be wearing on you, but the end is in sight," Deep Throat told Woodward. In the end, the subpoenas were quashed, but not before we had spent a great deal of energy and money. The intervening drama was intense. I wrote a friend, "The outrage of it is lost in the absurdity," also noting that one of the editors on the Post, who was not served, was said to be suffering from a case of subpoena envy. The administration also struck a tough blow at Ed Williams's law firm in connection with this suit. The firm had only about 25 lawyers at the time, five of whom worked at representing the Teamsters. After the suit was filed against the committee to re-elect the president of the Teamsters told Ed that the suit represented such bad judgment it reflected on the judgment of the firm. Ed's response was, "Nobody tells us who our clients are." As a result, the Teamsters moved its business. At the same time, though, we were gathering allies, however unwitting. One of the principal ones was U.S. District Court Judge John Sirica, who said he was not satisfied that the whole Watergate story was being revealed in his courtroom. Equally crucial, the Senate voted 70-0 to establish a committee to investigate Watergate and other alleged campaign abuses. I was on a trip to the Far East in behalf of Newsweek International when an important call reached me in Hong Kong. Howard Simons was phoning to tell me the stunning news that James McCord had written a letter to Judge Sirica charging that perjury was committed at the Watergate trial, that the defendants had been pressured to plead guilty and keep quiet, that higher-ups were indeed involved, and that "several members of my family have expressed fear for my life if I disclose knowledge of the facts in this matter." McCord agreed to tell what he knew about the original burglary in exchange for a more lenient sentence. What a relief! Or, as Ben would later write, bingo. This was the first real break in the case, and in the story, altering the reporting of the Watergate scandal from that point on, as well as changing the nature of reporting for the future. McCord's letter confirmed our stories, making what we'd said sound much more plausible and changing the image of the paper, as well as my own image in some ways. Suddenly, people realized there was proof to back up our reporting. There was evidence that what we had been saying was true. We had been through many long months of hanging out there, and now the press appeared in droves, finally lifting the rugs to look for leads. Piling on began. The Post was no longer alone, although we were still out front. We began to get more competition in reporting the story, both from other papers and from the news magazines, including Newsweek, which started to do cover after cover. So much that followed stemmed from McCord's letter: our increased visibility, my higher profile, more requests for speeches and interviews. All of this surprised me at the time and worried me later. Because I was still on the Asian trip when McCord's letter became public, mine was a baptism by fire, with interview requests pouring in from news media all over the Far East. But since the aim of the trip was to promote Newsweek International, I welcomed the increased opportunities to speak out. By the time I returned from the trip at the end of March, the situation for the administration had started to unravel. Henry Kissinger recalls that it was shortly after this that he began to realize Watergate was real and was not going to go away. Having been unable to fathom that our reporting might be accurate, Henry had worried mostly about the effect of Watergate on the development of our foreign policy and on the administration's freedom of maneuver in conducting it. Early on, he had had lunch with Joe Califano and had asked, "What are you Democrats going to do now?" To which Joe replied, "We're going to get well on Watergate." Henry then went to either Haldeman or Ehrlichman and said, "What's he talking about?" The response? "It's wishful thinking." But a great deal was going on behind the scenes at the White House, and several resignations were announced on April 30th, along with John Dean's firing as counsel. Elliot Richardson, the new attorney general, was given the right to appoint a special prosecutor. Nixon came on television at 9 p.m. that night. There weren't many televisions in the newsroom, so several of us, including Woodward and Bernstein, crowded into Howard Simons's office to watch Nixon's speech. It was one of those many times throughout Watergate when I just wanted to be at the paper with friends and in the thick of things. Bernstein and Woodward, who wrote everything down, even reported that when Nixon came on, seated at his desk with a picture of his family on one side and a bust of Lincoln on the other, I said, "Oh my God, this is too much." Nixon, in his speech, accepted the responsibility but not the blame for Watergate. He resorted to his old formulas.
"The easiest course would be for me to blame those to whom I delegated the responsibility to run the campaign, but that would be a cowardly thing to do. It was the system that has brought the facts to life, a system that in this case has included a determined grand jury, honest prosecutors, a courageous judge, Judge Sirica, and a vigorous free press."
After the televised address, he gratuitously stopped by the White House press room and said,
"We've had our differences in the past, and just continue to give me hell when you think I'm wrong."
All of this created a huge stir in the newsroom. Howard Simons said to staff members, "We can't afford to gloat," a sentiment that I shared. Though Watergate was no longer a lonely project for the Post, we were proud of the part we had played, but it was now on its way to becoming a national tragedy, and we had no impulse to flaunt our role, though every reason to feel relief at vindication.
Chapter 24.
In the middle of the worst of Watergate for us, things had deteriorated for me personally as my beloved colleague Fritz, ill with cancer, declined rapidly. By the last day of April 1973, Fritz was in the hospital in critical condition. He listened to Nixon's speech from his bed. His wife, Leanne, later told me that at the point during the speech when Nixon accepted some of the responsibility, Fritz raised his arm with his fist pointing upwards, and, as Leanne wrote me, "his face all one proud grin. 'Thank you, thank you,' he shouted enthusiastically. 'Great! Hurrah!'" That was Fritz's last salute to the Washington Post. Yes, he was fully aware of what was going on. He was beaming for a short while there, excited, thrilled about it all, and with you all. Fritz died the next morning. For me, the simultaneity of these events, confirmation of our reporting and Fritz's death, brought satisfaction and joy mixed with profound sorrow and loss. At the next day's press conference, Ron Ziegler apologized to the Washington Post generally and to Woodward and Bernstein particularly for his earlier criticisms of their reporting. Ziegler's statement surprised us all and also showed the extent to which he had been co-opted. Bob called him right away and thanked him, to which Ziegler responded, "We all have our jobs to do." I made a statement to news people who called, saying we appreciated the apology and accepted it with pleasure. "It was handsomely made. It was handsomely done. I'm happy to accept it." Only a week after Fritz's death, it was announced that the Washington Post had won the Pulitzer Prize for Meritorious Service for its Watergate reporting. Woodward and Bernstein were cited, and Herb Locke and Roger Wilkins were specially mentioned. As it turned out, the Pulitzer jurors, meeting weeks before the most dramatic developments in the case, had not voted a Pulitzer for the Watergate coverage, or for Woodward and Bernstein. Three other Post staffers had been named, however. David Broder for commentary, Bob Kaiser and Dan Morgan to share a prize for foreign reporting, and Bill Claiborne for local spot news for his reporting of a prison riot. After the McCord letter became known, Scotty Reston and Newbold Noyes, who were serving on the awards board that year, pointed out that it would hardly make sense for the Post not to be recognized for its Watergate coverage. We had entered the competition in the category of public service, but had not won, or seemingly come close, largely because the regional editors on the prize committee were so incredulous about the whole affair. After Scotty and Newby voiced their opinions, the board asked Ben whether he wanted the paper entered for public service or investigative reporting. Ben chose public service, for which the paper won the award. However, The Pulitzer jury also rescinded two of the Post's three prizes they had already voted on, with only David Broder retaining his for commentary. But despite Nixon's dramatic speech and the winning of the Pulitzer with its attendant confirmation of our reporting, the whole Watergate affair was far from over. Some of the rejoicing had been premature. Although we had gained credibility when Haldeman and Ehrlichman resigned, we still had an implacable enemy in the White House, albeit a weakened one. Much of the world remained with Nixon and continued to think that the whole affair had been vastly exaggerated. Some of the world still does. Many foreigners